Should I yell that out?
Hello, Beulah, roll the tape. Well, perhaps some of you were in the session I was in on Monday. I was participating back, just listening back here to Jody Kretzmann's introduction to the rainbow on the mountaintop theme for the next couple of weeks. And he was inviting people at that time to share some of their experiences of encounter, successful relationship across racial and ethnic and cultural boundaries. And I found that real interesting, and it caused me to reflect upon a project that Mark and I are involved in our own community, and to think that this might be of interest to villagers. So we're going to offer this, some account from our own community, which I think is not an atypical community. I bet it's like some of the communities that some of you come from, but you'll have to give us feedback on that. And it's something we're excited about, a new project about a year old in that community, which may be a model for others, may not be. It's still kind of experimental. We are excited about it, but there may be some learnings from it that we don't know about yet. In that session on Monday, a woman from Minneapolis confessed that she longed to have relationship with people from other cultural groups, but that she said, I just don't know any minority people. I mean, they're not in my neighborhood, they're not in my church, they're not in my workplace. I don't know any. I want to know how to build some bridges. And what we're doing, I think, is one approach to that. Let me tell you a little bit about where we're from and the background. Mark will tell you something about the project, which is a church-based project, and then I'll go into one aspect of it a little bit more. And we want to then leave a lot of time for your responses and for parallels in your own communities and other approaches to churches dealing with issues of poverty, race, and housing. We come from Valparaiso, Indiana. It's a county seat town in northwest Indiana. Population of about 30,000 people. It's 50 miles from Chicago. It's kind of on the outer fringes of Chicagoland. Some people commute in, but basically it's not a commuting community. It's a centered county seat kind of community. Gary, Indiana, which was once a thriving steel center, is perhaps 20 miles away. And many of the Gary has become predominantly black in the last 20 or 30 years, and some residents of Valparaiso have been white flight people from Gary. There's a Lutheran university there, Valparaiso University, where my husband teaches. Valparaiso is a very predominantly white town. And there are some things about its history which make people view it as a particularly unwelcoming town for minority people. Now, I regret to say this, but I think it's experienced that way by many people. In the 1920s, it was a center base of Ku Klux Klan activity. As recently as the early 70s, there were cross burnings in the town when integration began. And this in spite of the fact that it's a very church-going town, and so it's like many predominantly white communities in that way. Until 1968, there were no black families at all in this rather sizable and, you know, well-situated town. A few black college students would come through at VU, but they report there still are stories of the kind of hostility they encountered from merchants in restaurants, and so on. They learned where to go and where not to go. Well, of course, the 1960s changed a lot of people in the United States, and Valparaiso started to change in the late 1960s. One of these Lutheran college professors from the university, in the midst of the civil rights movement and the attention on urban problems that was characteristic of the late 60s, decided to start an urban studies program for students in inner city Chicago. Picked up his family of six, moved them into Chicago, and worked there for 2 years establishing a program for college students to learn about the city. became involved in all kinds of civil rights and activist organizations. Then it was time. 2 years were over. The program was there. It still is there. It's an important program in the education of many college students. He moved back, started to move his family back to Valparaiso. And a woman who lived in the housing projects in Chicago, this was after the urban riots and so on, it was a difficult time. A black woman lived there, had worked as his secretary in this program. She was a single mother of 5 children, and she was concerned about what was going to happen to her children in this impoverished urban context. And she said, well, why can't I move to Valparaiso too? It was just a very personal approach. Why can't I move to Valparaiso too? And he kind of thought about this and thought, well, I don't know, why can't you? You know, let's go. And was just serving as a friend, helping a person move in, okay? They started the process of transition, and turned out that every time she found a house to rent, or apartment to rent, or a house to buy, it would suddenly be rented out from under her. Suddenly be sold out from under her. Yeah. Even though she did have friends in the community. There was so much pressure against this initial step towards integration. So finally, this professor who owned a big lot in kind of an outlying rural part of town bought a prefabricated housing materials, called on the students and said, let's put up this house. They put up the house. And she moved in there next to him on the end of a little lane. There was various kinds of harassment. There was a cross burning. But also there were zoning harassments. They had to, even though it was the end of a country road, they had to put a big black top asphalt out and build sidewalks. And, you know, it was too bad. But finally she did move in. The and this got a lot of attention, okay? On Chicago television, but depicting the community as opposed, but this as a important step forward. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod picked up on this, the college students helping out picked up on this and made it the feature of a video or a film or something, which showed what you can do to help with integration. Okay? One church in particular became very involved in supporting her emotionally and so on. And she lived there, her children all grew up there and graduated from high school there, there they were. It finally was successful in her life. Ultimately, she had other friends. Finally, a total of 5 mothers, all single mothers with several children apiece, some of them on welfare, some with job trainings, job skills already, all moved one by one to Valparaiso, and a group of concerned white citizens helped them to, not really by buying them things, but by, you know, pitching in with labor, helping them financially at certain tough spots, but not really supporting them in general. Getting them into school. All 5 of those mothers graduated from Valparaiso University, which is quite an accomplishment. Gave them that kind of help. And so this was the beginning of integration in a predominantly white community. I think that's the relevant background. To say one of those women has passed away, 2 others are still there, kind of as matriarchs in the community, and 2 others, once their children were grown, moved back to Chicago, and their grown children and grandchildren are mostly still in the community. Okay, but and in the course of time, other families have moved in, a couple of professors' families, doctors, and others. But it still is considered to be, by the black residents of the town, to be a not very welcoming place. We have a friend who is a black attorney who is well qualified, looking for a job there, and finally was offered one, but the man was one of the partners in the largest law firm in town, said, I have to check with my clients first. He checked, and the job wasn't there. This was 6 months ago. The job was withdrawn. And we learned at that time that there is not and has never been a black attorney practicing in Porter County. in our county. So that's the background. Mark will tell you about how some church people are approaching this.
Okay, let me just introduce the two of us. My wife, Dorothy Bast, teaches at Chicago Theological Seminary, and I'm Mark Schwein. And I teach, as she has pointed out already, at Valparaiso University. What she has done, in effect, is to give you the kind of context and deep background to the story that I'm now going to unfold, which is really only a year long. It's really the story about Project Neighbors, and the reason I'm going to do this in story form is because I think it's true to say that Project Neighbors has more of a history than it does a nature. That is, it's easier to describe in story form than it is to describe in terms of a set of fixed principles or purposes or ideals or something like that. I'll keep that for the end of my discussion of Project Neighbors. Things have changed in Valparaiso since the 60s, even though, as Dorothy has said, a number of families find it still to be unwelcoming, the number of black families. It's certainly not like it was in the 60s. In other words, the kinds of cross burnings and so forth that she has described, we haven't had, thankfully, an incident like that in the last several years. And I think the fact that the census of 1980 showed 50 black families now in the town, and that number has increased since then, means that the community, though discrimination of the institutional sort that she just described with the lawyer who couldn't find work because of clients' objections, etc. He, by the way, did eventually find a job there in Porter County. And one should also add that the attorney who told him about checking with the clients first, what's interesting about that is what you would typically get in that situation is not someone being even that open. In other words, you would just be told, well, I'm sorry, we just don't have any openings right now. This time, the kind of dynamics of institutional racism became momentarily exposed. Of course, the attorney thought of himself as not being racist, and his clients not exactly as being racist, but the cumulative result of these people's attitudes was basically an instance of real discrimination, I mean, out-and-out racism. Well, community, though, is not, as I say, has changed somewhat, I hope significantly, since the 60s, but is in still difficult shape in some ways. The story that I'm about to tell you begins really about a year ago. Almost a year ago today, when this professor that Dorothy mentioned, who teaches at the university and who is involved in urban studies programs, same program that Jody Kretzmann's involved in, and a black pastor from South Chicago, South Shore Community Church, got together and after a number of conversations decided that there were a number of families living on the south side of Chicago who were in rather desperate straits. Problems having to do with poverty, problems having to do with the quality of the neighborhoods they lived in, so forth. And thought, wouldn't it be interesting to develop as an option for some of these families settling in Valparaiso, which has one kind of problem, but a number of problems that are true of South Chicago it does not have. And the more the two of them talked, and given some of this history, the more the two of them thought it would be a good idea. And about a year ago, the dean of the law school at the university put his house on the market, and then took it off the market quickly when he heard about this idea, and made it available at half price to a group of Valparaiso families who purchased it from him as a home for the black pastor and his wife to move to Valparaiso. And this house was to be used for two purposes. One, as a dwelling for them, as he worked to get a church started in Valparaiso. But two, as a kind of port of entry house where families that would be selected, screened by the South Shore Community Church, would come down and spend a weekend or two or three and look around and get a sense of the community and see if they wanted to make a move to Valparaiso. So that sort of ends phase one, the conversations between the South Shore community people, Valparaiso people, purchase of the home, and the alert being given to the families in the South Shore area that this option would soon be available if any of them were interested in exploring this option of moving and settling in Valparaiso. But now a whole host of problems arise, as you can guess. Housing, jobs, getting settled, transitioned into a neighborhood where you know no one, et cetera, et cetera. And here's where the second phase of the project begins, which is that a number of churches then become involved. Two initially, rather heavily, Emmanuel Lutheran Church and Christ Lutheran Church. And what these churches, in effect, did was to step forward and working in somewhat different ways, agree to sponsor a family who would elect as an option for them moving to Valparaiso. By elect as an option, I mean would respond to their own situation in South Chicago by suggesting that the problems they were facing could be addressed constructively by moving to this community of Valpo. Okay, so the churches then, I won't try to cover all the stories of the first two. Others are coming aboard. I can just tell you my church's story because I was the person who organized our church group. By this time, we'd gotten to have, as Project Neighbors, a kind of a fledgling organization. There were the two initial people, Reverend Jones and Professor Reiner. Then there were people from each of the prospective churches, one person each on something of a board. And then quickly we got the university involved, a number of students who were represented by students there who were interested in becoming a part of this whole project also. I got together a group of people in Christ Lutheran Church who I knew would be interested in this kind of thing. And we met four or five times. And tried to get a blend of people who had different sets of skills to help new families transition into community. People who understood the whole system of the county welfare system, all of that kind of thing, medical facilities that were available, etc. People who could help with childcare, people who could help with whatever, cars, etc. And in the meantime, Greg and his people gave us the name of a family. Woman, 28 years old, Lisa, and four children, Levi, Leah, Aaron, and Rachel, ranging from, I guess, age about, what is it, seven down to a year old. And we began very early to meet with this family. She had come down and stayed with Greg and Ida, looked over the community. We would have her down for lunch. We would go up there, some of us, and just talk about her aspirations as an individual. She made it known that she wanted to finish high school quickly through a equivalency examination, go on, get more education, eventually work with young children, but get a clear picture of what her needs were, what kind of housing she would need, et cetera, what kind of financial support she would need. And in the meantime, she was letting us know what she could expect from, what we could expect from her, in other words, what she could do the first year, what the second year, what the third year, so forth and so on. So there was a lot of kind of getting to know one another before she even moved to Valparaiso. Then this summer, was July, really the 1st of July, she moved there. We were able to find a home for her. We're able to find that really through other things going on within the larger Project Neighbors organization. And she's now settled there. And we did basically what Neighbors would do, which was everything we could to help her feel comfortable and at home there. And we're continuing to do that on an as-need basis, but also sort of regularly we have social events and so forth with the people in our church and her and other interested parties. Well, concurrently with this, the Emmanuel Church also has brought a family into Valparaiso, and the Methodist Church is about to do that. And I guess our whole organization now consists of a board of directors for Project Neighbors, consists then of monthly potluck dinners, which includes everybody in the community who is involved in any way, shape, or form with the whole venture, and of course individual functions that go on within the individual congregations in planning their individual missions. One more piece, and an important piece of this puzzle, is that Valparaiso has very little low-cost housing. So the Valparaiso Town Gown Builders Association sprang up to solve this problem. The VU students, VU has a large engineering college, and so there's some skill already in knowing how to build things. But more importantly, there are people who've come out who enjoy working on old houses, dilapidated houses, houses that have been given up for lost and that you can buy for a song in Valparaiso. These have been purchased, and students show up to work on these homes to get them shipshape every Saturday morning and as much time as they can late afternoons during the seasons when you can work outside, which in Valparaiso means basically the spring, the summer, and most of the fall. When the winter comes, you do the internal work. So already two or three houses, I'd say two and a half houses, have been refurbished by VU students and other people from the various congregations who like that sort of thing. So that's where the housing end comes from. As far as jobs and job training, we rely on one thing that makes Porter County attractive is it has a very good set of agencies for voc rehab. That has a very good Betty Ballard, one of the women who, from the 1960s, has started a daycare center and gotten federal support for Title 20 support because she does daycare for mothers who are on, what's the term I'm looking for?
EDC.
Yeah, right. So there's a network of institutions that are pretty good in the county to support families of the sorts that we have that have come there. So all of the other needs, for example, cars, car maintenance, home maintenance, and so on, are met pretty much the way neighbors and communities meet these needs. Somebody knows somebody who knows somebody who likes to do this sort of thing, and somebody knows somebody who can take care of that, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of the way that's working out on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis. Now, as I say, since this is less than a year old, it's a little hard to talk about its being a success or a failure because not all of the returns are in. Before talking about another very important institution that's grown up concurrently with Project Neighbors, let me just reflect on this story and give you some of the emphases that have evolved in the course of the project. And I can be fairly quick about that. One emphasis that everybody feels, the families that have moved there, the people in the individual parishes, the Town Gown Builders Association, all of those groups feel, is a real emphasis upon young people, the children. These families that have come in so far tend to be single parent and tend to have a number of very young kids, 7 years old on down. And the emphasis on that generation, they're getting good schooling, they're having safe neighborhoods to play in, et cetera, et cetera. Is really a pronounced one in the whole Project Neighbors undertaking. Another emphasis is that the community that's receiving these people is impoverished as much as the people coming, only in different ways. In other words, all the stuff you heard Dorothy tell you about Valparaiso speaks to a kind of spiritual impoverishment that it suffers from because of its sort of homogeneous character and because of a number of other things. So the people who are coming into our midst bring us kind of riches and resources that we as a community desperately need, just as the various sponsoring groups act to meet some of the needs that these folks have. So we think of this very much as a two-way street, have from the beginning, both in the way the whole structure has been built and in terms of the underlying rationale of the program. Final point, Project Neighbors. I think the inspiration for this comes very much from the whole question, who is your neighbor, which is asked in the New Testament of Jesus. And he gives a long answer in the form of a story, which most of you know. I think the sense of being neighborly, of dealing on a face-to-face basis with other human beings in need, when you yourself have needs that they can meet as well, has been the basic rationale and rhetoric of this whole program. There's very little talk in the program of any kind of, and not only is there no talk of it, there's no thought of it, grandiose and exalted experimental social programs. No one's talking about the program to end racism in northern Indiana or the program to whatever. We kind of get away from abstractions and basically face-to-face, person-to-person, what are your needs, what can we do for you, what can you do for us, what kind of expectations can we have of one another, how can we hold each other accountable to those expectations, et cetera, et cetera. Very much that kind of thing. And I think that's worked very well and has created already in this community, far beyond in terms of the ripple effect, just the people immediately involved in Project Neighbors, already a kind of healthy sense of high-spirited goodwill all the way around. Already all kinds of people's horizons have been enlarged and all kinds of people's lives have been enriched. I would say as much the people in the sponsoring groups in the churches have been enriched as the people who have moved to Valparaiso. So thus far, a kind of tentative progress report that suggests that some successes are taking place. But as I say, it's really too early to pronounce a kind of final verdict. Now I turn things back to Dorothy, who will tell you about another very important piece of this, an institution that's growing up concurrently with Project Neighbors, which I think really is as responsible for its success as anything else.
I'll be brief. Reverend Greg Jones, who is the black pastor from Chicago, who is a very important part of this, brought with him a message, which I think I would certainly share, and I think a lot of us involved in the project share. There can't really be any basic socioeconomic transformation in people's lives if there isn't also a spiritual transformation. And that a church, a worshiping congregation, was a necessary part of creating a good environment for persons of African American descent who might live in Valparaiso. Okay? And so we are, and I say we, I'm very involved in this congregation myself. He is a minister of the United Church of Christ. I am too. There is no congregation of that denomination in town. So we've been involved in a Lutheran church. But I became very involved in trying to help him get this congregation started. And it is an integrated congregation that worships in the style of the African American religious tradition. Okay? So there are three or four white families that are very involved and perhaps 10 black families. And it's just a very warm and exciting new congregation. And I think that it provides another form of welcome. You know, a sense of a heart at the center of the black community that might emerge in Valparaiso, which is very exciting. We started off worshiping in the afternoons in the Methodist Church after they were through with it, and now have moved to a place on campus. We hope to become an organized new church development of the United Church of Christ. On Easter Sunday, this year was we believe this to be the first time that worship in that style has been offered in our region, okay, in our area. And one of the women who moved to town in 1969 was there, and she was weeping, and she said, "You know, I've been to church, but I haven't been to a church that was from my own tradition on Easter for 19 years." You know, and it's very gratifying to see this. And some of the women who moved here long ago are very involved and feel this to be, you know, very, very important part of their lives in Valparaiso now. And I think I sense a rising self-confidence and self-consciousness on the part of those blacks who have lived in Valparaiso for a long time, who are now gathering, becoming a community, and welcoming persons of goodwill, you know, from other ethnic groups into that community also, which is, you know, just a very important part of this whole enterprise. So
That's all. I think we ought to have I can talk more and so can you, because we make our living talking, I'm afraid. That's our occupational handicap. But I'd rather have folks ask questions or share experiences in their communities like this one, or venture comments, whatever. I'd like to hear from you.
What's the reaction of the community at this point? Has there been any, have there been any incidents of more than there had before, or is there a change or what?
It's hard yet to make a definitive pronouncement about that. The official coverage in the local press, the Vedette Messenger, has been very favorable and positive. I mean, there was a very good story on Greg Jones. Did you bring the?
No.
And thus far, there hasn't been any public, meaning officially public, negative response. We have not, on the other hand, don't have a press agent who's issuing regular reports and attempting to get lots of coverage either. I mean, we have neither been high profile or deliberately low profile. We've just gone about our business. So it's probably too early to tell. The other half of that is that initially there was, within the immediate group of people who heard about this, were approached, did they want to get involved, etc., some questioning of the whole venture that went something like this: well, why are you people reaching so far afield here when we've got poor and homeless right here in Valparaiso, and so forth. That was initially, that issue had to be addressed. And it was good to address that issue, because in a way forced us to clarify our theology and forced us to think through for ourselves the answer to that question. I tend to take the question seriously rather than as a cloak for racist or whatever attitudes. I take it to be a genuine question. And what we basically said was, look, the whole question of who is the neighbor and how far does neighborliness extend is one of the central animating principles guiding Project Neighbors. And as a matter of fact, Christian love is not a zero-sum game. In other words, it does not follow that because you're helping person X, that now you're less likely to help person Y. As a matter of fact, the way things work out in practice, it's the very people who are giving to save the children, who are active in Project Neighbors, who are active in PACT, which is Prisoners and Community Together, which is a strictly local Valparaiso project. Those people tend to be often the same people. So Christian love tends to sort of feed off itself and expand, and we were all able to talk that over and talk to other folks in the community about that, and I think that issue has been addressed. It's also been addressed in that one of the houses that the students finished was ready before the third family from South Chicago was ready to move there, and a poor family in Valpo was evicted from their apartment due to some unscrupulous practices on the part of the landlord, and that family then moved into that house. So in other words, Project Neighbors, just by being ready and having housing available, was able then to meet the needs of one of the very families that people were initially worried about that we weren't addressing. So there's been a little of that, but there's been no either ugly individual incidents, nor have there been any stuff in the press that's been negative. And in part, I think that's a tribute to the careful work on the part of these churches who have gone around and the families moving in, who have quickly gotten to know the neighbors, meaning the people that live next door across the street in the general vicinity, and letting them know all what's going on and being quite above board about it. I think that's really helped the transitional situation for these families moving into that area. These families take great risks moving to the area. For them, it's a very gutsy thing, very risk-filled thing to do, and their courage there has been also a large part of the reason that there has been not yet any real negative feedback.
Who owns the houses?
Well, right now, Project Neighbors Incorporated owns them. The gentleman who started Walt Reiner from Valparaiso started this along with Greg Jones, owned some of these properties, and then he in turn has either sold or leased them to project neighbors, we in turn sublet them to the families. And what we do is to let the families know that we'd like to work out a 3-year deal with them whereby increasingly they meet the full cost of rent and then begin on a contract basis an option to buy it for themselves. Our notion would be that ultimately, if that's what they would want and aspire to, we'd like to work something out whereby they could ultimately own these homes.
Would that financing be something like a Habitat?
Pardon me?
Will that financing be something like Habitat?
I know. How does Habitat work?
Well, Habitat has the thing in there where they have to provide so many hours of work. The family is going to move in.
No, it's not like that. They don't have to do any work on the homes themselves.
Well, when they finance it, I'm not sure, but I think it's on a sliding scale.
Hmm.
And works up. And one more question. Are both big Lutheran churches in town involved in it?
Well, the big Lutheran church in town is Emmanuel, and they are involved, definitely.
What about the ELCA? Is that the Missouri church?
That's Missouri church.
What about the ELCA church there?
That's Christ Lutheran.
Are they involved?
That's the smaller of the... Of the two
big
ELC.
But there that's
two
the big ELC ones of the churches. ELCA, right?
There are two ELCA.
Yeah.
Ours is small, formerly ALC. We're involved. The large, formerly LCA, is not really involved.
I'll have to go nail Smith's Hyde.
But we hope that they will be. You know, it's there are several congregations that have been identified.
But what he has said, he hasn't mentioned you specific, and he's I was in his wedding. From what he has said, in talking with him, be patient. Mm-hmm. And it's the best word. The best word I can give you is be patient. He's mm-hmm. just been there long enough now to realize that take it easy, it'll get done.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds strange, but that's the way it's going to work there.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any history in Valparaiso of resettlement of Southeast Asian refugees?
Yes, at least... We only moved there in 1983, so we may have missed some of that. I've heard that the United Methodist Church had a major program.
And are those people still in the community?
I don't know.
I don't know the answer.
I mean, they don't have visibility as seen by...
No, but it's clear that the whole community is becoming more diverse just every year. I mean, there are a number of Asians that, you know, very prominent and visible. You know, I don't know if they came by that route.
How does the now existing black community react to the efforts? Are they enlisted in them?
Well, that's where the congregation comes in, more than the Project Neighbors itself. The evangelism plan of this congregation calls for contact, you know, making the offer of church membership to these people who probably desperately need and wish for, you know, long for in some way a church home, and who probably come from a certain style of worship and theology, which this will provide. And then this congregation within months will be sponsoring a family also, so that's interesting.
Have any of the black families become involved in city government, the school board, or anything like that?
You mean the ones that have moved under this project? No, they're just basically getting settled in the community. But who was the one you were telling me was head of the soil and zoning project?
Once the black community starts to identify itself, you know, we're spectators to that, really, in a sense, in a community of this sort, it turns out, for instance, you know, the postmistress and the person who's in charge of building permits and the community which had perceived itself as entirely, you know, so predominantly a white community, when you give people a chance to identify themselves and to say, we value your presence, you discover that, yes, there are a lot of people who are really...
Do you have black teachers in the public school system?
There might be one or two.
There might be one or two, but
I'm
not.
Probably not. Probably not too many.
Mm-mm. I doubt it.
Probably not. Mm-mm. For instance, the postmistress told me that she is... the only black employee, and there are 135 employees in the post office.
Yeah.
So,
are the black people dispersed throughout the city, or are they in one community?
Very dispersed, very dispersed. But I would really like to know what is going on in your communities that might be, if you have similar problems, if you know of other approaches. I'm asking a question. I want to make one more point. you know, my background and approach to things on the job and so on is often to try to be effective and to, you know, get government funds and do as much as you can and put up big structures and so on. I've never been involved with housing, but basically to do things in an organized and large-scale way. And the face-to-face quality of this is really very interesting and very appealing and very, in a sense, more challenging than writing a grant proposal, you know. To know that there's a real family down, you know, in down around the corner who really can call you and ask for something out of your day's schedule, you know. To learn what, I mean, do you know what in your own town a family, a woman, unemployed woman with four children gets in assistance and food stamps? Well, now the people in our group know that now. And we know if there are or are not doctors who are interested in treating her. You know, we're starting to learn these things about our community. It's very, very interesting and moving.
I live near Lima, Ohio. I live in the only white township in the Commonwealth. We're the only township that is selling property right now and selling it at good prices. You put your house on the market today, it's gone in a couple of weeks. And part of the undermining is it's all white. But in Lima, by its lack of concern for the people, black and white, we have a sizable black community, sizable unemployed black community. 60 to 65% of our housing is substandard by code. Mm-hmm. And the city, the mayor, in his wisdom, tried to defend that, so he appointed a housing task force to study the problem. And somehow it got in the hand, a couple of clergymen in town got on it. And they found out that people in the community are saying to them, if you people don't get on this, get involved in this city, we're going down the tubes, guys. If you guys don't start talking about what it means, who's your neighbor, what's your responsibility, and is it? And as one of the executives of one of the big chemical plants said, I don't care what color skin we're talking. Mm-hmm. He said, you fellas are the ones that are supposed to have been doing the job. And he says, I hate to tell you, but some of the evangelicals are so concerned about saving the whole world that they miss what the gospel is saying. And this is a layman talking to a bunch of mainline churches. I mean, he's not talking to the storefront churches. He's talking to a wealthy Presbyterian congregation, a couple of powerful Lutheran churches. And he's saying, you fellas need to get active in this community or just wipe us off, one or another. The problem they have is the animosity, that's not the right word. I think there's a distrust between the black community and the white community as to whether or not the white community is as concerned as they make motions at. Because they don't see the results. Mm-hmm. They don't see the results. And when you've got 60% of your houses by code are substandard, something's wrong. Mm-hmm. Something's wrong. You don't have to be a Philadelphia lawyer to figure that one out. But the pastors have taken the invitation. The mainline churches have gotten together and somehow they invited me to be in it. My congregation finds out I said yes, they're going to be angry, but I still said yes. They'll get over that. But we have decided now that we are going to try to work with the community and we don't need a program like you have as much as we need a program to get the community awake to its possibilities. Mm-hmm. And not that it's a dying community, it's not. It's a good community to get a job. There's a lot of good paying jobs there. And they do hire the blacks. But there's still this underground ferment is a good word. And I suppose you've got some of that there. And if you talk long enough, they'll finally come out and ask you why you're helping anybody. Mm-hmm. That's where we are. But the thing that fascinated me is the fact that the top businessmen in town were telling the clergy, hey, you guys, get out of your office and get active in the community. Let's quit horsing around now. Mm-hmm. And none of the pastors and priests expected to hear that, because I've heard them say that a couple of times now. They were just startled when this guy said to them, hey, get your hands dirty. It won't hurt. You can always wash them.
How about other minorities? Do you have them?
Oh, yes, there's a sizable population, Indian population, doctors mainly. I mean, they're very middle class, upper middle class.
Not Native American, meaning Indian.
Yeah, right? I understand.
And Filipino, I think. Some Hispanics. Mm-hmm.
Don't you have the end of the migrant workers in there?
I'm not aware.
No.
I don't believe so.
What support is the university giving besides student help? Any support or any involvement?
Well, the again, Walt Reiner, the gentleman who I've mentioned, is due to retire, and the university has given him some of its money to courses involving students whereby they could get academic credit studying the problem of housing, et cetera, but also be working on these houses. I mean, combined kind of working in the community and studying these larger problems. So he's given him support for that endeavor. The president has been very helpful in the ways that a president can be in terms of underwriting and helping and giving his imprimatur to the whole arrangement. That's been helpful. He's been that way right from the beginning. Project Neighbors applied for a grant early on and got a small grant from Wheat Ridge for transitional funds for the first four families that moved in. And the president had heard about this and signed off on the grant right away, and you know, made the university kind of a co-signer to that, guarantor of it, so on. I suspect the university will become progressively more involved. The approach that I think has been taken both with regard to the university and with regard at least to our church is something I think really taught me a lot. Someone said here at Holden, we couldn't remember who, we were trying to discuss this, but we were here the last time 6 years ago. A lot of Christians, white, black, whatever, have the right ethics, but they just don't know who their neighbors are. In other words, they tend to treat human beings pretty well. And I mean, treat human beings out of something like Christian love. But when it comes to which human beings or knowing who your neighbor is, then they get all confused. And I have found this to be absolutely, well, not absolutely correct, but truer than I had realized when, in proceeding with our church, we let each church proceed as it wanted to in terms of developing its support groups. Some of them took the official approach, let's tell the pastor, get his approval, then meet with the committee on social concerns, etc. Some people worked that way. We worked in that I just got together a group of people from Christ Lutheran, 8 or 10 of us, and then they suggested other names. We got a critical mass of people, I don't know, 10 to 12. Then we, after meeting and hearing about the project and deciding this would be our project, then we informed the pastor that we were up to this, invited him to join us if he wished. If not, could we have the forum a couple of Sundays in April when we would be introducing our family, etc., etc. He said that was great, that this is what Christians are supposed to be doing, things like this, and so on. And then we arrived at the forum, one of them with Greg Jones and I, and one with the people in the congregation who had undertaken the project and so forth. And once you have real human beings present, a family, and can you help this family, and then, of course, it's what can we do, et cetera, et cetera. And people actually do pitch in and become interested and ask, can they join the group? And of course, the answer is always yes. But if you proceed the other way around, I mean, if I had taken this to the same group of people in some kind of church committee on social concerns and said, hey, how about doing this? We'd still be meeting to consider reasons probably why we shouldn't and probably why we should do something else instead. And 2 years, we'd have talked about 19 different things we could do instead, but done nothing. So what I do find is that when you actually have something on hand, when you go to the president of the university or you go to the vice president for academic affairs and say, here we've got students building houses and yet there are courses over here on the problem of housing and urban problems, can we put these together? Well, this is already happening. Well, sure, now they'll lend their support. But if you had gone at the beginning, no houses up, no students involved, whatever, no families in place, and said, hey, how about a program that combines community action and involvement on the part of the students with studies of these problems. Well, I don't know, we got to take this up to the faculty curriculum committee, and gee, I don't know, academic credit, and where are we to get the money? I mean, we'd have just been endlessly. So my, I suppose, rule of thumb is, if you get an idea, carry forward on your own with 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 or 12 people, and then once it's underway, then say to folks, say, here's this kind of thing going on. Here are these people who are here and they need this and that. And people will respond. But if you go to them initially and say, how about doing X? You'll be meeting for 5 years and still nothing will be done. But you'll have thought of 50 reasons why not to do this. That's what you'll be thought of.
You still did use your core group, though, as members of your...
Oh, yeah. They were all members of Christ Lutheran.
And that was quite deliberate.
That was quite deliberate. And we let the pastor know right away what was going on. And the fact that we were going to be eventually approaching the entire congregation with this, and that was all fine. The Emmanuel group worked differently. I think they had they kind of basically took over one of the committees of Emmanuel. And it's an official, quote, church project top down. Others will probably, the instigator will be the pastor at some of the other churches. I can see where things are going there. It'll be the pastor who will be the initiator and so forth. So there's different models for different churches, and frankly, I'm not here to advocate any one as better than any other, because these communities have different chemistries and traditions and way of going about it. I'm just saying some one way will go well when your community thinks of some project it wants to undertake. That's what I'm saying.
Wow.
Well, I can see people are
it's about time for, about time
hungry, so thank you all.